Welcome back to Cold Brew. On this episode, I'll be sharing the tragic story of a young high school athlete whose death was initially ruled an accident, but many believe the true cause of death has been covered up. You are listening to Cold Brew, a true crime podcast fueled by Cold Brew Coffee. I'm your host, Caitlin Brewer, and if you like what you hear, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find me on social media, at Cold Brew Crime, to see images related to this episode. Hello, friends. I'm so glad you're joining me again. I feel very off schedule, but it's all right. My coffee today is actually canned Starbucks Nitro Cold Brew, and I'm a big fan of Starbucks Cold Brew. It's actually probably the most frequent cold brew I drink, unfortunately. Where I live right here, there's not that many like local coffee shops, so it ends up being Starbucks more often than not. But I was actually just going to pick up Starbucks cold brew for this episode. And then my husband saw this can version at the grocery store, and I was like, well, heck, I'll just give it a go. So this is the first that I'm trying it. Oh, gosh. Did y'all hear that? I'm scared. Oh man, I guess that's really that nitro in there. It just like sucked that back down in there. Okay, let's take a swig. Okay, I'm gonna have to go get ice. Okay, I am back with ice this time. To be honest, this isn't as good as it is at the store. Probably not gonna get this again, but it was a first time try, so. Yeah, that's what I'm drinking. Hopefully next week I have some really exciting coffee to share. I'm really excited. So, you know, come back for that. And yeah, so now that you know what I'm drinking, I'm just going to do a quick word from our sponsors and then I'll be back with the case. The case that I'm sharing with you today has so much information. Unfortunately, it's not all factual because, you know, that happens a lot. I've tried to research as thoroughly as possible just to sift through what isn't backed up by evidence. So I'm really trying to just present you the facts and not just kind of rumors and hearsay and media stories. So there are some topics about this case that I'm choosing really not to discuss in detail or very much just because I don't feel like there's enough evidence to target specific persons of interest or for that to really hold, you know, weight in this case. Okay, so let's head on down to Valdosta, Georgia. Valdosta is about 25 minutes from the Florida state line, and it's right in the center of southern Georgia. So, you know, like center of the state, very bottom of Georgia. It's a fairly decent sized city. It appears to have a small town, kind of hometowny vibe, just from looking at photos and Google Maps. So it kind of seems like the place where Friday nights often involve football, kind of revolve around football, and everybody makes plans around game nights. The town looks to have a lot of southern charm and historical buildings around the main parts of town. Valdosta serves as the county seat for Lowndes County, and it's the most populated area within that county. So this unfortunate story begins on January 10th, 2013, when Kendrick Johnson did not return home from school. You know, his mom, she kind of knew that he wasn't going to be home right after school because he normally goes to the basketball games. It was a Thursday, so I would assume that it was JV just from my basketball days. That's the way it went. So she knew he was going to go to this basketball game, and he would normally call a family member once the game was over to come pick him up. So when she still hadn't received that phone call by 10 p.m., she started to worry. She actually drove to the school to, you know, kind of like see if she could find him there. So when she got to Lowndes High School to see if he was there, the school was dark. Nobody was there. Lights were turned off. The parking lot was empty. She then went home to call 911 to report her son missing. When the officer had arrived to her home, it was approximately 12:30 a.m. on the Friday the 11th at that point. Ms. Johnson stated that the last time she saw Kendrick was at 6:30 a.m. on Thursday morning when he rode to work with her. She worked for the Lowndes County Transportation Service, so he would ride with her to work and then get on the bus number 34 to take him to school. So that was a normal thing that they did. Kendrick Johnson, often referred to as KJ, was born on October 10th, 1995. He was 17 at the time. He was 5'10", weighed 165 pounds, was African-American with a slender build, shoulder-length dreadlocks, brown eyes, black hair. He was a three-sport athlete at Lowndes High School, and he had hopes of playing professional football. Kendrick was described by family and friends as handsome, quiet, and considerate. So by, 4 a.m., 6 a.m. the next morning on January 11th, there was still no sign of Kendrick. Sergeant Craig Roby arrived at the high school around 8 a.m. after receiving this missing person report. He went to confirm that Kendrick was in fact not present at school, and then once confirmed, he proceeded to meet with Miss Johnson and her daughter that were waiting at the school basically to talk to whoever they could. So they discussed a few students who may know where Kendrick was. One was a close friend of his that was actually suspended. So, they confirmed that Kendrick was not at this kid's house. Really, everyone else that they'd spoke to had not seen him since earlier the day before in school. So by 10:32 a.m., Sergeant Roby was dispatched to the old gym at Lowndes High School. You can find photos of this old gym online, actually, and it resembles to me more of like a middle school gym or like an auxiliary gym. I mean, it's exactly what it's described as, the old gym. Like, they clearly built a new gym, and this is the old gym, and it has the old equipment or lack of equipment. Kind of seemed like where the cheerleaders would practice. It had one basketball court and had a few, like, two-level movable bleachers, so nothing was really permanent. It really wasn't organized-looking either. It was kind of very just scattered. During a morning gym class, two students had made an unexpected discovery when they were hanging out on top of the rolled-up gym mats in the corner of this gym. So these gym mats were fairly large and would be used for cheerleading practice or wrestling practice. From the photos, it looked like there was two different types of mats. So one type looked to be like tan and much more compact, whereas the blue ones were really thick, didn't roll up too tightly. There was several of them over there in the corner, probably at least 10, maybe 15 mats from what the photos looked like. These mats would definitely take two people to raise or lower. They were probably heavy. You can't just throw those up there. When these two students were on top of the mats and they said that they were just up there to like hang out, they had no real reason to be up there, they saw what looked to be like socks sticking out. So when they went over there to see, they immediately were like, nope. And they yelled for one of the coaches that was supervising the class to come over. Once he climbed up on top of the mats, he saw what looked to be a body inside of this mat and called out to one of the other coaches. They started moving all the mats and it's kind of like the smell hit them and they both were just like, we got to get these kids out of here. So they yelled for all the kids to go to the new gym. Basically, one of the kids that first saw the socks had already called 911. Dispatch was already en route. Things were moving very rapidly at this point, and these coaches were very, I'm sure, distressed. The students on top of the mats also stated that they called out to the person in the mat to see if they needed help and got no response. So once the coaches got all the other mats out of the way, one mentioned that there was definitely a bad smell, and, that's kind of when they realized what was happening. The two deputies and Sergeant Roby arrived to the gym. The incident report for this case is actually online since it is a closed case. That's where most of my information comes from, basically verbatim from the case file. The family of Kendrick Johnson also released almost all of the crime scene photos and their own photos as well of him, and you can actually view those online. You can also view the coroner's video of the scene, like on YouTube, and honestly, I personally had to stop watching it halfway through because I just did not feel right watching it. I did not feel like it was something that needed to be shared. It felt very personal. So I don't recommend Googling too much or digging into this unless you're fully prepared, because it does get very graphic and it really is kind of hard to process and take in. Once these officers arrived to the scene, they noticed the odor first thing again. They saw one of the coaches bent over the mat that appeared to have the body in it. They're assuming that the coaches had laid the mat down, because that one mat was, you know, now horizontal on the floor but still rolled up. The mat measured roughly 3 feet in diameter, rolled up, and about 6 feet long. The hole in the center had a diameter of about 14 inches. Sergeant Roby stated that he could see 2 feet with socks on and what appeared to be denim jeans. Once he got to the other side of the mat, he stated that he observed a black male torso and head, and that both arms were partially blocking the face but were stiff. He noted that the face was severely swollen and disfigured. The images online, again, are very graphic, so I don't recommend that you look at those unless you feel the need, but it is really difficult to tell that those photos are actually Kendrick Johnson when you compare the photos of the autopsy and before to the face of Kendrick Johnson's photo provided by his family. Like, it's disturbing how much it doesn't look like him. Just to recap, Kendrick's body had been found in an upright gym mat inside the gym in the middle of the school day. There was blood present at the scene, and his face looked relatively beaten up and swollen. Now that Kendrick's body's been found inside the gym, there wasn't that much other than just a few pieces of notable evidence. The shoes that KJ was wearing that day were orange and black Nikes, size 9. Those were found inside the mat with him, behind his knee. His feet are at the top of the mat, and these shoes are like resting on the back of his leg. There was another pair of black and white Adidas shoes, size 9.5, on the floor inside the mat underneath his body. I'm not sure if both shoes were inside the mat. That wasn't very clear, but the shoes were there. Investigators also found a hoodie with traces of blood on the sleeve, as well as traces of blood on a wall nearby. This blood seemed to be very old and not related to this case. They did run DNA, and none of this blood was a match. They did not take this hoodie or the orange and black Nikes into evidence. They also found an LG cell phone in KJ's left pocket, and that got sent off to get data retrieved. All right, so after the initial autopsy, the Georgia Bureau of Investigation stated that Kendrick died from positional asphyxia, and the case was ruled an accidental death by the Lowndes County Sheriff's Office. They claimed that after gathering evidence and other information, they believed that KJ was trying to retrieve his shoe from inside the mat and got stuck. According to some students, it was common for them to throw their shoes over or on top of these mats when they didn't want to pay for a locker in the gym, and that his shoe might have fallen into the mat with a larger hole in the center, hence why he was in the mat trying to get it. So according to Wikipedia and a few other sources online, positional asphyxia is a rare cause of sudden death and a difficult diagnosis. Based mostly on the circumstances of the incident, it occurs when someone's position prevents the person from breathing adequately. People may die from positional asphyxia accidentally when the mouth and nose are blocked, or when the chest may be unable to fully expand. One of the most unexplained aspects of this case for me is that the black and white Adidas shoe, or shoes, there was only a photo of one, so I'm unsure, that was found under Kendrick's body was sitting on top of a pool of blood, but it was underneath him, meaning it should also have blood on it if it's in between him and the blood. It just doesn't make sense that this blood has dripped down and just somehow has not gotten on this shoe, but it's all over the floor. So if all the blood did rush to his head and eventually onto the ground in this unfortunate position, again, how did it not end up all over his shoe? after this information is shared with the family, they immediately disagree with the ruling from the sheriff's department. They feel like the decision was very quick, within less than 48 hours, and that the sheriff's office didn't even consider foul play and whether that played a role in his death. The family also felt like Kendrick's body had been moved, and the coroner actually agreed. The coroner claimed that he was not notified of the body until 6 hours after it was found, which is against Georgia law, and states the coroner must, like the Georgia law states that the coroner must be contacted immediately. And another argument the parents made was that how did no one hear Kendrick call for help if he was in this position? But then again, what if the positional asphyxia came on so fast that he didn't even have a chance to call for help? I mean, this high school has 3,000 students. There were classes going on in the gym during that time, and there was also color guard practice later that evening. There was a lot of people in this gym, and it's honestly really disturbing that nobody noticed. There is video surveillance that was obtained from the school. However, there's some that believe the footage could have been tampered with and parts of the video deleted because it appears there's blocks of footage missing. And from the timestamps, like potentially an hour of video footage missing, it was explained that the timelines are a bit skewed because there are so many cameras within the school that there's 3 separate servers. Therefore, it's very difficult and almost impossible for all of the times on these cameras and servers to sync up. So footage from the hallway on the south end of the school might have been shot at the same time as the video in the gym, even though the times don't match up. So that creates a very iffy timeline, a very difficult way of processing. It's also worth noting that this surveillance footage was not properly saved. I watched a news report and they had given the surveillance footage to someone very high up in the surveillance world. He stated that it was just not properly saved. It was not properly delivered. There was protocols that could have been broken and that he didn't feel very good about it. I personally didn't spend much time researching the surveillance footage because I just don't believe it's a factual and valid source of evidence. You know, there's clips that show KJ walking into the gym and then the screen freezes and random new kids pop up that you didn't see 1 second ago. So apparently the cameras are light and motion activated. I don't know, they just don't seem too reliable to me in this case. So by June, the Jackson family had hired someone to do an independent autopsy. These results showed the cause of death was not positional asphyxia, but was blunt force trauma to the right side of his neck. The examiner noted it specifically as, end quote, unexplained apparent non-accidental blunt force trauma, end quote. He also stated that findings were in line with rapid onset death and they were not consistent with positional asphyxia. So that means that positional asphyxia, I guess, would probably happen over a longer period of time, whereas this blunt force trauma happened fast. After these results were released, the Johnson family stated that they believe their son had been murdered. October 31, 2013, the U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Georgia announced that they would open a formal review into the death of Kendrick Johnson. After the independent autopsy, the Johnson family got some more disturbing news about their son. Sometime after the body had been recovered at the scene and had passed through a funeral home, it had been stuffed with newspaper. The funeral home that processed the body following the GBI's autopsy stated that they never received Kendrick's organs from the coroner. His internal organs were said to have been destroyed through natural process and were discarded by the examiner before the body was even sent back to Valdosta. That was according to the funeral home owner. And he said that this created a void, he called it, and they had to fill it. The funeral home owner stated that it is standard practice to fill a void in this fashion and that cotton or sawdust may also be employed for this purpose. The Johnson family filed a complaint against the funeral home operator, which ended in them filing a civil suit against the funeral home. After this, the Johnson family requested that Kendrick's body be exhumed for a second time. This case involves so much legal action, and that's honestly kind of what it has become, unfortunately. It was a little hard to keep track of, so I'm going to summarize it as best as I can. The Johnson family filed a wrongful death lawsuit against the Lowndes County Board of Education, its superintendent, and the high school principal. The suit alleged that Kendrick was violently assaulted, severely injured, suffered great physical pain and mental anguish, and was subjected to insult and loss of life on January 10th, 2013. While the lawsuit did not name the person or persons allegedly involved in the January 10th event, nor identify the race of the alleged perpetrators, it implied a race-based dimension to the assault they presumed happened. The lawsuit alleged that the defendants were negligent and violated Johnson's constitutional right to equal protection based on race. It alleged that the defendants ignored reports that previously Johnson had been repeatedly attacked and harassed by a white student. It alleged that Johnson was attacked on a bus trip 14 months prior to his death. The lawsuit further alleged that another student had a history of provoking and attacking Johnson at school, stating that it even happened in the presence of the coaching staff and employees of the school. The suit also alleged the school officials failed to properly monitor the activity of students throughout all areas of the campus and to maintain a properly functioning video surveillance system. In August of 2014, the parents of Brian and Brandon Bell filed a $5 million lawsuit against Ebony Magazine after the magazine published a series of articles naming these two students and brothers as possible suspects in Kendrick's death. The magazine didn't use their real names, but was otherwise pretty accurate in describing these two boys, including the fact that their father was an FBI agent. The article used as a source an anonymous email to the sheriff's office that alleged the younger of the two brothers killed Kendrick after learning that he had fooled around with the brother's girlfriend. Rick and Karen Bell promised that their sons were not involved in the death and are not considered suspects. They have been harassed as a result of this article, so that's what they claimed in their lawsuit. In January 2015, Kendrick Johnson's family filed a $100 million civil lawsuit in the Superior Court of DeKalb County against 38 individuals. The lawsuit alleged that the FBI agent ordered his two sons and a classmate to attack Johnson. Kendrick Johnson's family alleged that his death was a murder and accused the individuals of a conspiracy to cover up the homicide. By November 2015, the Department of Justice filed a motion to intervene in the civil case. The U.S. attorney said allowing evidence discovery in the civil case to continue would have a chilling effect on the federal investigation, which had expanded into investigating possible obstruction and grand jury witness tampering. After the DOJ's motion was denied, Kendrick's parents dismissed their own wrongful death lawsuit, saying that they hoped to refile after the DOJ's investigation. The Johnsons were then sued for more than $850,000 in attorney fees and $1 million in defamation damages. On June 20th, 2016, the U.S. Department of Justice announced that they would not be filing any criminal charges related to Kendrick Johnson's death. They stated, end quote, "After extensive investigation into the tragic event, federal investigators determined that there is insufficient evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that someone or some group of people willfully violated Kendrick Johnson's civil rights or committed any other prosecutable federal crime." And last, on August 10, 2017, Georgia Judge Richard Porter ruled that the Johnson family and their attorneys must pay more than $292,000 in legal fees to the dozens of people they accused of foul play in the lawsuit that they had previously dropped. Okay, so really the last update was that the family requested a third autopsy in June of 2018, and that autopsy did confirm again that the cause of death was blunt force trauma to the neck and that it could possibly have been caused by a dumbbell. So unfortunately, Kendrick's case remains closed as of now, but it's received a lot of media attention within the last few weeks. You probably have seen it over Facebook recently, you know, in light of all the recent events in America. Many believe that Kendrick's case did not receive the attention it deserved because of his race. Unfortunately, this has been true time and time again and would not be unheard of in southern Georgia even today. There's an active petition on change.org to reopen Kendrick's case, And with a goal of 1.5 million signatures, this petition currently has 1,431,926 signatures. All you have to do is Google Kendrick Johnson's petition, and I'm sure it'll pop up. Personally, I can see both sides of this case. I can see him actually getting stuck in this mat because he was much bigger than the mat and squeezing down in there. I think it would be hard to get back out. I think that his shoes could have potentially came off because he was trying to grip the sides of the mat to get himself out, and that, you know, his shoes slipped off and then there he was just stuck. It would make sense why his face would be so swollen from being upside down so long. If all of that was the case, those few things do or could make sense. But what I just can't understand or make any sense of is the shoes below his body not being covered in blood, or his black puffy eye, or that not a single student heard him yell, unless the positional asphyxia happened so fast that he didn't get to, or that no one noticed he never came out of the mat. And lastly, why was the coroner not called until 6 hours later? And then there's the messy video footage. There's a lot of this case that doesn't add up. Whether it was a tragic accident or premeditated murder, the Johnson family may never know the truth, and unfortunately, Kendrick may never get justice. Cold Brew is recorded, edited, and produced by me. To be sure you don't miss future episodes, please subscribe to Cold Brew True Crime Podcasts wherever you listen. If you like what you hear, please leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. You can send any questions or comments about this episode to me on social media at Cold Brew Crime. Stick around to hear a great new podcast from a fellow coffee lover. Thank you all so much for listening. I'll see you guys soon.
Love true crime? Love coffee? Then be sure to check out my podcast, True Crime and Coffee, where I, your host, Simone North, talk all things true crime, from notorious serial killers, unsolved cases, strange disappearances, and much more. True Crime and Coffee is not only a podcast, but a place for all of us true crime junkies to sit down as friends and talk about fascinating cases over a delicious cup of soul-soothing coffee. So grab a drink, put on your detective cap, and head on over to the True Crime and Coffee podcast.